Let's take our Bibles and open together to Acts chapter 2. We're going to look at a segment of Peter's sermon in Acts 2. And if you have a copy of the lesson, turn to page 5. We'll pick up tonight with number 7, the discussion of miracles. This is our second class on some basic concepts that are pertinent to a study of the resurrection and a survey of some worldviews that the resurrection is a stumbling block to. When we talk about the resurrection, of course, we are talking about a miracle, and not just any miracle. It's been called the chief miracle. On the sheet, we note that miracles are supernatural events that reveal God's existence. The miracle that does that would be the creation. They reveal His nature, such as the Exodus, revealing that there is only one unique living God, or they reveal His purpose, the resurrection doing that by providing for and accomplishing God's ultimate goal of man's salvation. These events are God's direct intervention in the natural world that often suspend or overturn nature's laws. We'll talk more about that in a second. These events, by definition, cannot be explained by laws of nature. If they can, then there is no way for us to know that something beyond this world, something supernatural, has intervened and manifested itself. Miracles give man an objective reason to trust and obey God and His Son. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 22, you have the first gospel sermon that is preached. Peter gives four lines of evidence to convince his audience that Jesus is the Christ. The first one are the miracles. I want you to pay attention to the three words that he uses to refer to the signs that Jesus performed. He said that he was attested by God with miracles. Excuse me. And another way to render that word that he used would be a work of power. Thus, it's a word that points to the source that gives this act its ability to be what it is. He also refers to it as a wonder or a sign. These are things that were intended to provoke a reaction in the people that witnessed them. A wonder is the effect for the cause. Here is a supernatural event, but it is designed to stir wonderment and contemplation in the one that witnesses it. A sign, of course, points to the significance of something. To get people's attention, a miracle has to be something that is out of the ordinary, just like Jesus would often get people's attention by using words out of the ordinary. He would tell people, "You need to eat my flesh and drink my blood." It was up to the person that witnessed the miracle to accurately read the sign. This was a hot debate 2,000 years ago. Some people said he cast out demons by the power of demons. Other people said if he was not from God, he could do nothing. It's up to each person to look at the sign and evaluate what it tells you as to the source of the person's power and what you are to glean about the person that is working it. It's interesting, by the way, that at least prior to the resurrection, nobody challenged the fact that Jesus worked wonders. They said he cast out demons by the power of demons. They never said he did not cast out demons. They couldn't deny that. On the sheet, on number 7, I mentioned that these events are God's direct intervention in the natural world. They are His direct intervention as opposed to His indirect intervention. And by that I refer to providence. When God works through providence, it may not necessarily be apparent that the hand of God is at work. So, for example, in the book of Esther, God is never mentioned. It's only ever raised as a possibility that He is behind everything that is happening. Mordecai tells Esther, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Mordecai thinks that Esther may be a pawn in God's cosmic game of chess to save His people. Now, if she had parted the Red Sea, if she had called down 10 plagues, Mordecai wouldn't have said, "Who knows?" He would have said, "We know." And that's the difference between a miracle and providence, when God acts between one of those two avenues. If you also look at what we have on the sheet as far as what a miracle is, I said that they often suspend or overturn nature's laws. So sometimes a miracle, the wonder that it is ultimately to provoke in someone, it's not immediate. And what I mean by that is when God told Pharaoh and Joseph that 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine were coming, the only way to know that that was revealed by God was to wait for it to happen. Whereas when Jesus walks on water, the effect is immediate. And in that moment, he suspends the law of gravity. When he comes back from the dead, he overturns one of nature's laws. It says that life does not come from non-life. That's the key difference in the signs that we're talking about and other ways in which God has manifested himself directly in the world through revealing prophecies of future events and so forth. Any questions or comments about miracles? Alex?
There were in the Old Testament too, the Elijah taken up in a chariot of fire. He brought the dead young boy back to life. Christ brought Lazarus back to life. So they're evident in the Bible, all through the history of the Bible, from the Old Testament to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and afterwards through the apostles.
Yeah. There is a long string of them throughout God's Word. That leads us into actually the next thing that we want to talk about on the sheet. Anybody else got anything they want to add on the subject of miracles? Okay, naturalism. Naturalism is a philosophy that I guess was popularized most by a man named David Hume. David Hume was a brilliant economist. He was a brilliant political theorist. Unfortunately, when it came to spiritual matters like miracles and other things, he was very much off the mark. The philosophy of naturalism says that everything that happens is naturally occurring. So, 1500 years ago when the Enlightenment was going on, when lightning would strike the ground, people would look for an explanation for that. What caused that? Some people might say, well, it's the wrath of God and just leave it at that. Other people that were more curious might wonder, maybe there's a natural explanation that would tell me what exactly caused this bolt of lightning to pop out of the air and hit the ground. When you have a man like David Hume who comes along, he takes this to the utmost extreme and says that everything has a natural explanation. Supernatural occurrences such as miracles are flatly denied. Anything that either seems to be or is claimed to be miraculous either never happened or it has a natural explanation. So, if you read about the people of Israel walking through the Red Sea, I'm sure the naturalist would say there is a completely reasonable explanation for that. Perhaps they walked through a very dry portion of the sea, and a strong wind came from out in the Mediterranean somewhere that helped take whatever shallow waters were still on the ground, move them out of the way, and thus this miracle was accomplished. Lord willing, we want to talk about naturalism more later on in our class. I just want to explain to you a little bit more how someone like Hume, his reasoning works or doesn't work, as the case may be. A guy like Hume would say that there has to be a natural order in order for a miracle to stand out, and I would agree with that. The sun goes up, it comes down, or at least that's the way we perceive it. When dead people die, they stay dead. If that wasn't the case, something like Jesus coming back from the dead, it wouldn't have any special significance to anyone. He's right about that. What he would argue is that since miracles are very rare and natural occurrences are very common, and the evidence for the common is greater than the evidence for what's rare, and since smart people believe something based on the amount of evidence, smart people should not believe in miracles. Now, the way that Hume talks about the things that are common is he reasons from experience. Every person, Hume might say, that I have known that has died has stayed dead. Has that been true of you? It's been true of me. I'd have to at least agree with him on that. Every person I've known that's died, they've stayed dead. But he says, experience confirms what we witness in everyday life to always be the norm. Now the problem with that is, Hume has not, nor has anyone else, ever experienced every single thing that has happened in the world. We know whether you believe that it got here by God speaking it into existence or you believe it by the Big Bang. We know that somehow the universe started. We don't experience that day in and day out. By his own reasoning, he would have to conclude that we never got here in the first place. You have to have experienced every single thing to say with certainty that there never has been a violation of natural law. Also, another mistake that he makes, he confuses, let me make sure I say this right, he confuses quantity with probability. In other words, he says when you have a lot of something happening, that means that's probably what's going to happen. So the fact that there have been a lot more deaths in history than there have been resurrections means that it's probable that someone is going to stay dead when they die. Now, I agree with that. I'm not going to expect anyone I hear about on the news that died today to wake up tomorrow alive. I agree with him insofar as that statement goes. But what he's saying is we should always believe whatever has the highest odds of happening. Does anybody in here play golf? Really, you admit it? I don't. I'm a Christian. Have you ever hit a hole in one?
No.
No? You ever known anybody that's hit a hole in one?
Technically, no.
Technically, no. You ever heard of anyone ever hitting a hole in one?
Yes.
Is it more probable than not that a person would hit a hole in one?
Probably not going to happen.
It's probably not going to happen. So if it's probably not going to happen, according to him, I ought to believe it will never happen. But people do hit holes in one, don't they? Just because it's rare doesn't mean it never happens. So this guy thinks that he's got it all figured out, but the more you test his thinking, I'm not so convinced. That's the philosophy of naturalism. We'll hope to come back to it later. All right, let's turn over to Romans 1. And let's talk about atheism.
I come from lost miracles. People say, hey, I saw Jesus' figure on the screen. No one.
Well, there's no doubt that in today's world, people often claim that they have witnessed miracles, and the evidence is very scant at best. And we also live in a day and age when there are many counterfeit miracles, just as there were 2,000 years ago. There could be no question that that helps to contribute to the skepticism toward the miraculous. But just because there's counterfeit $20 bills in circulation doesn't mean that you should stop using a 20, right?
Just give them all to you.
Just because there's a counterfeit miracle today doesn't mean that the evidence for the resurrection falls apart. Let's talk about atheism. So, yeah. He was around in the 1700s, and he's very much in vogue even today. Did anybody watch the TV show Lost? I'll admit that I did. Okay, one of the guys on the show, the Scotsman, and Hume was Scottish too. His name was Desmond David Hume, and it was meant to be ironic because Desmond would always say he believed in miracles, and he would talk about how he would see people in the next life and all this stuff. And the only reason that's significant is because Hume, whether it's popular culture, whether it's academic culture, on college campuses or wherever, he's still very much read, and he has a lot of disciples today, even though he's been dead for 200 years or more. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Atheism. Atheism asserts that which it cannot prove. They say God does not exist. Prove it. Prove it. You can't prove it. I don't know that you can prove any negative to begin with. They say that God does not exist. In Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about this frame of mind in chapter 1 and verse 18. He says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now, the truth that gets suppressed is not the truth that Jesus is the Son of God. He's talking about things much more basic than that, the fact that God exists to begin with. He says there's two motives for this suppression in verse 18. The first is ungodliness, which is an evil state of mind. And the second is unrighteousness, which is an evil way of life. So wrong thinking, wrong behavior, these things motivate man to deny God's existence. Nobody really wants to be held accountable if they're living an evil, ungodly life. That is the constant struggle within man and has been since the devil has lured him into sin. Now, what do? We can look at the evidence, we can look at the creation, we can face the music, try to find out who this God is, or we can just ignore it, deny it, live any way we want to. This has some dire moral and eternal consequences. These are familiar to all of us. In verse 26 and 27, Paul talks about some sexual perversion. Back then, even the most common sense things that people could glean from biology, that a man is for a woman and a woman is for a man, those things became twisted and corrupted. And we can all relate to that because we've seen just how far today the erosion of common sense, basic principles of sexuality, it's all been thrown out the window. And now we live in a world of transgenderism and people identifying as anything and everything that they want to. In verse 28 and following, you have this catalog of sins that grows out of failing to acknowledge God for who He is. And this has been called the roll call of the damned. Almost every single wicked thing that grows from a sinful mind is listed in this text. Now, if you backtrack up to verse 20, Paul says that there is no excuse for this. Since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes... Then he tells you what he's got in mind. Two things. His eternal power and divine nature. They have been clearly seen. That sounds weird. How can that which is invisible be clearly seen? Anybody ever read or seen a movie adaptation of Robinson Crusoe? So he's on the island by himself. You remember how he discovers that he's not alone on the island? What does he see? Footprints. Footprints in the sand. Doesn't see the person. He sees the evidence that a person has left in their wake. And that's the argument that Paul is making here. How do we know that we're not alone? None of us have seen God. I can't take someone who's an atheist to some corner in the world and say, look, there he is. But just as there were footprints to let Robinson know he wasn't alone, the entire universe are the footprints to let us know that we are not alone as well. Sir? That's right. You can't see the wind, but we see the after effects of it, right? Right. We can't see the maker of all things, but we see the after effect from when he first said, let there be light. Paul said these things have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. So if you are an atheist, Paul is essentially saying this is illogical. Everything gets here somehow. This building didn't just happen to get here by itself. That same statement is true of your vehicle. And if everything has a maker, then so too must the universe, the heavens, and the earth. That's essentially what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 3 and verse 4. The builder of all things is God. He's not arguing for a creator, but that statement applies to the discussion nonetheless. Back up in verse 1. Paul says that Jesus was declared the Son of God with power by what in verse 4?
Resurrection of the dead.
This is another big problem with atheism. Not only is it illogical, it's ahistorical. And what I mean by that is it's not concerned about history. History tells us that a man came back from the dead. It ignores documented past events. And it invents undocumented events like the Big Bang. Nobody saw that. Nobody wrote about it. Nobody came along later that had any credentials like Moses did with the Exodus to say, let me tell you how we got here, spontaneously and accidentally. We are concerned with the study of the resurrection with historical authenticity. The shorter word for that is historicity. That's what we're interested in. An atheist throws all that out the window. Thoughts or comments on atheism?
They look for different excuses to deny God as well. You know, I lived in New York City when 9/11 happened, and I had a bunch of people telling me, you know, God exists, but all these horrible things happen. And that's one of the crutches they will lean on. So much evil in the world, there can't be a God.
Yeah. I'd say probably the three biggest challenges to faith, not the only ones, but the three, are the theory of evolution, the fact that there are so many religions, and the problem of pain and suffering. And these three mountaintops provide us something to lean on in the face of those challenges. And time permitting, toward the back half of this study, we'll look at how the resurrection can help us with the question of pain and suffering as well. All right, let's go over to the Gospel of John. Chapter 18, we want to spend just a few minutes on the philosophy of agnosticism. This philosophy says that absolute truth cannot be known or discovered. And in particular, what they refer to is absolute religious truth. So the question of whether or not there is a God, whether or not Jesus is the Son of God, the agnostic would say, you can't know that for certain. Does anybody see a problem with that statement right off the bat? If you tell someone that there is no absolute religious truth, what if you just revealed to them? You just made an absolute statement. This philosophy is contradictory from the word go. How on earth can you state with certainty that someone should be uncertain when it comes to these types of matters? None of us should pretend, I'll get to you in a second, John. None of us should pretend that we have all the answers. There's a lot of things I don't understand in the Bible. There's a lot of abstract things like the Trinity I can't fully work out. But I keep going back to what's concrete. Keep going back to the fact that there's an empty tomb in Jerusalem, and there's a way to explain that that makes sense. There's a lot of ways to explain that don't make any sense. John?
I was just going to say agnosticism is built on what you said, where there is no certainty. It's built on no certainty to begin with. For them to make that statement just kind of falls in line with the way they feel about things. It's basically, usually I find out with those people, they just really, it's a crutch.
Yeah, yeah. In John chapter 18, we have Jesus when he's before Pilate. The question before Jesus is in verse 33, are you the king of the Jews? In verse 36, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Therefore, Pilate said to him, so you are a king. Jesus said, you say correctly that I am a king. Jesus tells Pilate, the king you work for, Caesar, he's got a very peculiar way of gathering more subjects. He invades anybody he wants to. He conquers anybody he wants to. He sends his soldiers in. That's how he has more people paying taxes to him, more people exalting him as their ruler. I'm not like that. That's not the way that I will collect subjects. He said in verse 37, everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. That's how I'm going to collect subjects. Pilate evidently understood this. Had he thought that Jesus was a radical, that he was trying to reign on this earth, he would have gladly executed him. But he didn't want to. He understood what Jesus was saying. But here he is, faced with a man that he can find no fault in, claims to be the king of the Jews, understands some spiritual dimensions of his statements that the Jews don't understand, and now he's going to make a choice. I don't think the man's guilty. If he's not guilty, that means I'm guilty if I go through with this. But what happens to me if I don't go through with it? I've got my other king to answer to back in Rome if I don't go through with it. So, in verse 38, here's the dodge. What is truth? Now here's a man who knew better. He just didn't like where truth was leading him. So to bypass having to make a hard decision and face the consequences in this life of that decision, he just decides to put his head in the sand and be an intellectual coward and dodge the plain evidence that's standing right in front of him. That's where a lot of people are today. They may not have a good answer to the holes that you might poke in evolutionary theory. They may not be able to explain the resurrection. according to many of the explanations that are offered up, such as a hallucination or any other thing that people invent. And so for them to get around the fact that they are being backed into a corner and they don't have to make hard changes in their life, they'll say, well, you just can't be certain to begin with. You be the judge for yourself. I feel like I can be certain. And Lord willing, we'll go through and talk about why that is. But if we're right, there is nothing to be gained by sticking your head in the sand when it comes to Jesus. Page 6. Yeah.
There's also a danger of people that claim to have faith. They have that attitude that, well, I just feel like this is right. Grandma did it like this, or mom and dad did it like this. They dodge the necessity to study Scripture and find out what the truth is and act on the truth.
So unbelievers, as Craig said, they're not the only ones that can try to dodge having to wrestle with the facts. People that profess to be believers, they can do the same thing. And it might be a lot easier for us to build our faith on tradition or what family has passed down to us than an examination of the facts. But I don't see where that's going to benefit anyone. And that'll be something that we'll talk about a week from tonight, Lord willing. All right, deism. We might think, why on earth do we need to talk about this? I don't know too many people that are deists. You may know more than you realize. And especially if the five things that I have listed here for you that people say are beliefs that more and more people have, you may know a lot of deists. And the main thing about a deist is they don't understand their need for Jesus. 200 years ago, they might flat out deny that he was the Son of God, because that would be a miracle, and they deny that miracles happen. And a lot of people today don't understand that their greatest need is a sin problem. We'll talk about what they think it is instead. The deist believes in God, but only because his reason and the natural world lead him to that conclusion. Now, why would somebody get there from that perspective? Deism came from the Enlightenment, which is also called the Age of Reason. I mentioned a moment ago the question of what causes a lightning bolt to come out of the sky. Well, you could go to a pope or a king in Europe in the 1700s, and you could ask them, and they'd say, oh, it's the wrath of God, you better be good. Or there were all these other guys that were showing up on the scene, like Isaac Newton, starting to wonder, maybe there's a way to look for an explanation in nature. And what people began to do was question traditional vessels of authority. And in many ways, this was good. It led to the Industrial Revolution. It led to modern science. The same impulse to question authority, I think, contributed to the Restoration Movement here in the United States and elsewhere. It went to some awful extremes in the French Revolution. They went so far as to change even the calendar. They invented a 10-day week. They didn't want anyone to know when the Sabbath was, because the new God was reason. Of course, they're Catholic, so they think of Sunday as the Sabbath. Didn't want anybody to go back to those old superstitions. And modern leftist movements, they're all the grandchildren of the French Revolution. In this day, reason as a necessity eventually came to be reason as all-sufficient. Your reason essentially was God. So I don't need a silly book of fables like the Bible to tell me what's what. I can do what Paul mentioned in Romans 1. I can look at the natural world and reason that there is a God. But I don't need some guy like Paul saying that he was guided by the Holy Spirit. I don't need to worry about Jesus walking on water or coming back from the dead or being the Son of God or anything like that. I'm only going to believe in what I can think myself through to. I don't need any special revelation from anyone else. So in this view, the God of deism set the world in motion, and then afterward he never got involved in it. Just made the world. The analogy is he had a clock, he wound up the clock, let it go, it started ticking, then he never looked back. In recent years, sociologists have coined the term moralistic therapeutic deism. And no normal person speaks that way. You can tell it's a social scientist just by the mouthful that you read there. And they use that to describe the religious views of young Americans. You got children, grandchildren? Might want to pay attention to what their friends believe. Some of these things, these modern manifestations of deism, they will be confronted with. So the first thing, a God exists who created and ordered the world and watches over human life on earth. Well, that sounds good. Then you get to the second thing. God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. Anybody see the show on Friday nights, Blue Bloods? Tom Selleck. Got some Tom fans in the audience? All right. So in the show, normally every single episode, this Irish Catholic family, they sit down, they have lunch together after they go to church on Sunday, and they just talk about things. And people love that aspect of it. It shows family bonding over a meal. In one episode, they were talking about religion, and Tom Selleck's character said that all religion boils down to this: do right by your fellow man. And essentially what that tells you is that in his thinking, and in the thinking of probably most people, that's all you need religion for, just to give you some good moral guidelines. But as we talked about on Sunday, if Jesus is the Son of God, we need him for a whole lot more than that. I need a redeemer. I'm not always a good moral person. I need something to take away my sin problem. Some religion, as we're talking about this expectation on letter B that people have as to what God would require of them, some religion is obviously irrational and would encourage people to do wrong to their fellow man. And surely reason demands that we not treat all religions as being equal. And I would argue that the resurrection points to an absolute standard of truth. Look at letter C. The central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. This is why they call it therapeutic. People today think their biggest problem is a fractured self-esteem or mental depression. And I know people struggle with those problems. I know they can be real problems, but the fact is that is not man's biggest problem. Sin is man's biggest problem. And a sin problem can make you crazy. Sin problem made King Saul crazy. Sin problem caused Judas to throw his self-esteem out the window and kill himself. If Jesus is the Son of God, if he is the Lamb of God, takes away the sin of the world, my biggest problem is not how I think about myself. It's my sins that keep me condemned before my God. Letter D, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when God is needed to resolve a problem. I think I know brethren that feel that way. That's pretty sad. I hope that if we can appreciate the resurrection, realize we need Jesus every day atoning as our high priest, we cannot just learn to turn to God when life gets tough. Do it every single day. Letter E, good people go to heaven when they die. My question would be, how do you know there is a heaven if the resurrection is not true? My question would be, who gets to define who the good people are to begin with if the resurrection is not true? So again, if the resurrection is true, then a religion, A through E, that might sound kind of sort of close to what you believe, it still falls completely apart. All right, number 12. Got just a few minutes. Sorry, Levi?
I'm reminded of this. This is the whole idea of let your moral compass be your guide. I'm reminded of the nation of Israel in Judges 17. Those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own sight.
Yeah. 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 And back then it was pretty bad. There might be people today that would fall into the subcategory of deism. They would look at what happened in the book of Judges that Levi referenced and they'd say, well, a lot of that stuff shouldn't happen. But the question always gets back to, how do you know it shouldn't happen? Who gets to call the shots in that? Paul told the Athenians, there is a day of judgment coming, and I know that's true because the tomb is empty. If the tomb is empty, somebody gets to call the shots. If the tomb is empty, somebody gets to set a standard and hold everybody accountable to it. If it's not, every man for himself. Alex?
I visited a church once in New York that believed in universalism. Everyone's going to be saved. God is such a loving, good God. them to see the good and find that one good thing in everyone, and everyone's going to heaven.
Yeah, it's a nice thought, but it still doesn't help me deal with the empty tomb. Still got to come to grips with that. All right, number 12, paganism. We can look at Acts 17. We'll skip it for the sake of time. Most of us are familiar with that. The belief that many gods exist, and pagans consider the religions and practices of all cultures as being equally valid. This has been true for a long time. When the Philistines took the ark and they began to suffer because of it, they talked about the God of the Israelites, and yet they still clung to their own gods as if, by virtue of being a Philistine and a member of an opposing nation, you still had a deity that you could turn to, but another people had a deity that could also mess with you a little bit. So what this means in practical terms, religion is true only for the individual worshiper, not universally true for nor applicable to everyone. You clearly see that in Athens. When Paul starts to talk about the resurrection, people begin to laugh. That's true for you, silly little Jewish man. Not true for me. That's what you believe. It's not what I believe. Western civilization is rapidly repaganizing. Even if people are not going back to the old gods of Zeus and Apollo and others, they are still embracing more and more this concept of everybody's on the same level playing field. Jesus is no more special than the gods of Hinduism or any other gods that are out there. Nobody should be so bigoted as to claim that their religion and their religion alone is what's right and is the path to salvation. Western civilization is built on three pillars. From the city of Athens, she gets her rational and scientific mind. From the city of Rome, she gets her political and legal mind. And from the city of Jerusalem, she gets her moral and spiritual mind. Each of these pillars are being rapidly eroded and torn down. The one that is being attacked most vigorously of all is the city of Jerusalem and everything that Western man has inherited from having the Bible in its culture for 2,000 years. Once upon a time, people would never have contemplated putting Islam on the same footing as Christianity, even Christianity in its perverted forms. But that has rapidly changed. So we live in a world now, just like Paul, you go into a city, there's all kinds of gods. And that's one of the big challenges that people face. How can there be one God when there's so many religions? How do you know? Well, you tell me. Did Odin come back from the dead? Did any of those gods come back from the dead? That's the key. That's the stumbling block to each and every one of them. All right, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I would agree, Ennis. They were all false gods to begin with. So some key takeaways. When it comes to Christianity, the resurrection is the crux of the matter, or the heart of the matter, as we sometimes say, the basic, central, critical point of an issue. Interestingly, crux is Latin for cross. In English, crux means difficulty or puzzle. And the resurrection is definitely a difficulty or a puzzle for the atheist, for the agnostic, for the deist. In 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 23, Paul said, "We preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, to Gentiles foolishness." That is true today. And if you confront a good and honest heart that is willing to sit down and weigh the evidence, I am convinced that no matter what their belief system is, it will come crashing down when confronted with the evidence for the resurrection. Second thing, as we just talked about, it's the stumbling block to every other worldview. It's also the crux of the matter in that, as we discussed on Sunday, the resurrection is it's everything. It's the theme of the Bible. It's the means of atonement. We need to treasure it. We need to know it. We need to know how to defend it. If it's false, there's no point in being here. I like everybody in this room. Glad to have met you and known you. But if it's false, there's no sense in us calling each other brethren, having anything to do with each other, apart from the fact that we may enjoy each other's company. Just get rid of the whole thing. It is everything. And finally, you don't need scientific proof to know that the resurrection happened. You don't have to witness it for yourself. You don't have to depend on some feeling in your heart. The legal historical method is enough to demonstrate the historicity of the resurrection, its historical authenticity. The evidence we have consists of oral and written testimony of eyewitnesses and people that spoke to them. The two eyewitnesses, Matthew and John, the two that spoke to them, Mark and Luke. Everybody has to weigh the testimony against the facts of the case. You have to determine for yourself if the testimony is credible, and you have to decide for yourself. Everybody you meet and talk to has to decide for himself or herself, do I have enough evidence to believe? We may not always think like that, because many of us were privileged to come from Christian parents. And a heritage of faith was instilled in us at an early age. I am thankful for that. I know that you are too. But you still had to make a choice. Everybody else has to make a choice. And don't let the idea that people have to determine if there's enough evidence rattle you. I think, at least it's true of me, if you consider it for yourself, your faith will not be shaken, it will be strengthened. Final thoughts or comments before we end our class? All right, thank you for your attention tonight.